Hi, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing very good, thank you very much, and I appreciate it. Start from the beginning. Now, you were raised, you grew up and raised in San Francisco and went to school and college in San Francisco.
I was born and raised in the Oakland area. Born in Alameda, raised in Oakland, and then college in San Francisco at San Francisco State.
Obviously, you grew up in the Bay Area in an amazing time, not just the 60s, but the 50s with the Beats and things like that. How did you grow into that world in your life growing up and touching those different worlds from the Beats to the basically the hippie generation?
I was too young to be part of the beat scene. I'm not sure that I would have had a great interest in it anyway. That was happening when I was around maybe 10 to 12 years old. And so I was not in a position to go around exploring North Beach.
Right.
our family was a Chinese restaurant family, so we were all kept occupied between chores at restaurants and homework and Chinese school. So no, there was no way that I could have gone out and socialized with any social or cultural group. And it wasn't until the 60s when I was in college, having graduated high school in 62, that I began to see the changes going on both on and off campus. And so began to immerse myself into the scene, but primarily as an observer or a reporter or a chronicler. You know, I never dove into the protest scene or the drug scene or whatever. It was really observing it and saying, this is a good column or this is a good story or that's a good beat for our newspaper to cover. I was an editor at the San Francisco State Campus Daily in those turbulent years of around 65, 66. So I was there when San Francisco was pretty much hip action central. And we also noted what was going on in Berkeley with the free speech movement. And so it was all stirring around that time. And I was quite fortunate to be where I was and working for the school paper and radio station, in a sense, reflecting it and covering it.
Well, how did you get to writing? What put you into writing, and what was the inspiration behind that?
Well, the inspiration behind writing was reading, and being stuck in a restaurant as a young person, there weren't too many escapes from the drudgery and the chores of that life. And so I found myself both listening to the radio and enjoying some newspaper columnists and books, authors of books, especially humorists, and all kinds of music. And they were just kind of escape hatches. I just happened to decide that not only did I want to read, but I wanted to write the kind of stuff I was enjoying reading, and that I also wanted to make the kind of music that I was enjoying hearing. So I had some musical ambitions, but once again, from childhood into college, there really, really were no opportunities to take lessons, to play around at home, because we were usually at the restaurant, and by the time we got home, it was time to go to bed. So I made do, and I wound up basically playing music on the radio and just kind of getting involved on whatever level I could. But that was pretty much the inspiration for both writing and music.
So did your family frown on you writing? Was that something, obviously, they wanted you to help with the family business, or was it something they encouraged you?
Neither. They didn't really know much about what any of us kids were doing because of the communication, the language barrier. So we just kind of did our own thing. And as long as we weren't getting into trouble, it was fine. And I suppose, as with so many ethnic cultures, they wished that we would get white-collar professional jobs. And that wasn't meant to be, but they would have liked it, but they didn't seem to oppose the directions that I was taking.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's always an interesting frisson, that, isn't it? But now,
yes.
You tried some musical instruments. Which ones did you attempt?
Well, again, I had no access to instruments or a place to play or practice.
Hmm.
And so I would say that my main interest would have been piano and drums. Those are the two that I liked the idea of being able to play the most, but did not do either, really. I had bongo drums. It was just whatever was the most portable. I should have taken up harmonica. At least that's really, you can just throw it in your pocket or a ukulele. But then later on, in very late, just recent years, I have picked up a guitar. And so now I strum chords on the guitar and can actually get through a couple of songs reasonably well, considering I don't do any kind of finger picking. So that has been part of my life in the last few years. Oh, the remainder. No, I've actually performed with them already.
You're at SF State, and obviously that was an amazing time, a lot of foment all over the Bay Area, all over the country. And you saw it transform. You saw that, I hate to say it, but the hippie movement kind of burgeon out from the diggers or whatever, and you were witness to that. Can you give us a flavor of that time, if you can, any touchdown on any certain events or people that can...
Well, it's a wide canvas to try to describe, but basically it was young people who were seeking change, who were not happy with the establishment, with authority, with the world presented to them, with the problems around the world between wars and the beginnings of assassinations, and they just thought that there was another way to do things and to live, and so change was probably the biggest thing in the air, and freedom, the feeling that one should not be restricted in terms of career goals, where one lived, with whom one socialized. All the rules were beginning to change. It was driven by young people, and there were more young people than ever before with the changing demographics of the country. And so they found support when they went out and tried to have a concert or stage a protest against a war or for civil rights or whatever. It was that sense of unity and community, and also underlying it, depending on where you stood politically, a sense of just fun and freedom, or a sense of purpose and activism. There was a chasm between at least two different groups of people, and in the Bay Area, it was most easily defined as San Francisco for hippies and Berkeley for the political activists, the free speech movement, People's Park, University of California, folk music, whereas in San Francisco it was really more psychedelic music, so-called acid rock, free-form radio, gatherings in the park, concerts on the street and in the ballrooms. So that was in part what it was like.
Right, and of course, in here we are 50 years ago this year, where everyone's celebrating the anniversary of the Summer of Love. Obviously, a lot of things happened that year, and including Sgt. Pepper came out, and Summer of Love, and of course the first issue of Rolling Stone,
yes,
which you joined after that. Can you? Tell us about that year and how you got to join Rolling Stone.
Well, I won't tell you about the year. That would take an hour to just tried to figure that out. But yeah, Monterey Pop Festival was there too, and so many of the major landmark events and I hate to call it product, but as you pointed out, Sgt. Pepper was also in 1967, and so many other artists made great music or made their debut albums and were unveiled at Monterey Pop. Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix were not really known musicians until that exposure. But later that year, around October, Jan Wenner came up with the idea of a more serious rock-based magazine. It would never be just rock or just music, but he'd been thinking about it for some time, and so he got support from family and a couple of crucial supporters like Ralph J. Gleason of the Chronicle, who was a jazz critic with open ears to other kinds of music. And so they pretty much put together the first issue of Rolling Stone in October, November. It was dated November, but I'm sure that it had been in the works for a month or two before that. So that became, it was not a sensation. It was just welcomed as what Jan intended, a more serious-minded treatment of rock and roll music and the rock and roll, the pop culture of the time, whereas the mainstream media ignored it or put it down, and the music media didn't exist, basically. There were a couple of magazines that ran song lyrics, like Hit Parader and Song Hits, but that was about it. And there were some people beginning to write seriously about rock, notably Paul Williams with Crawdaddy magazine. And the kids in Michigan were beginning to think about Cream magazine. But it was Jan who probably had the biggest initial success. It took a while. The first issues went unsold, basically, because nobody knew what the heck it was. But once the word spread, then it became quite the buzz around San Francisco anyway, and then within a couple of years nationally. And it was just a very simple black and white for a tabloid, a quarter full tabloid newspaper, and that went on for about half a year, I think, before they changed the format so that you actually had a cover. And then from then on, you know, it just took off, and I was a reader from the very beginning because it was so unique and interesting and sometimes humorous. And so I kept track of it here in San Francisco and was able to get a story idea in March or April of 1968. And so once I got into the door with a small item, I was able to be part of their freelance staff. And so I wrote pieces for them on and off for probably a year before Jan called me in to become an editor. And that was in May of 1969, and I hung out for about maybe 11, 12 years serving as various editorships, serving various roles, culminating in being the senior editor running the music section in the, I guess that would be the 70s primarily, and writing a bunch of cover stories and touring with the musicians and writing the random notes and dealing with our freelance and correspondents around the country and around the world. And it was a busy, pretty amazing time.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Just reading about it was exhausting enough.
Yeah. And on Sundays, in 1970, I got a call to that led to my taking on a part-time gig at KSAN, which was the major free-form album rock station in town. And so I wound up doing part-time and weekends while also at Rolling Stone. And I think I was at Rolling Stone probably 6 days a week, and then on weekends wedged in a shift on KSAN. And then sometimes I mixed both of them by having Stevie Wonder or Steve Martin or, let's see, who else? Cheech and Chong and other musicians that I was working on stories on would come by to the station and play guest disc jockey. And so that added to the station. And, of course, I got something out of it, too, because I could observe these artists doing something other than just sitting talking for an interview or performing on stage. So it was a great combination of jobs.
Wow. Yeah, you have to be young to do that.
Yes.
My goodness, yeah, and obviously radio, that's the big thing. We'll talk more about that later. Now, obviously you've done hundreds of interviews and over those years, and I just saw a quote that you did, that you used to send out Cameron Crowe to handle the difficult bands. So did that work well? Or
Well, we when we got Cameron Crowe in there in the early 70s, and he was just this kid who was very enthusiastic about a lot of different bands, including some that we had just kind of gotten tired of, and some who hated us. And we figured sending a fresh-faced teenager who's not awestruck, because he learned pretty quickly what we wanted from him in terms of objectivity and a distance and not be cozying up to the artist and, you know, being a fan, to be a serious reporter. But he had that enthusiasm, and that pretty much got through to all the artists that he interviewed. Hmm. Some of them were just interviews in town, like in San Diego or Los Angeles, and then he did go out on tour a little later, because he really wasn't too young to tour. He was only about 14 or 15 when I gave him his first assignment at Rolling Stone.
Oh, my goodness. So, I've done 500 interviews, and I must admit, I read one really bad one, or it just didn't go well, and that was with John Mayall. But have you had any that you'd really hoped was going to go well and just didn't?
I can't say that for sure. There are those that didn't go well after I wrote the story. They were unhappy with it, but that's not the same as an interview going wrong. The only dramatic moment was Bob Dylan. Surprisingly, once he sat down to do the interview for his tour in 1974, I believe, with the band, and he said, "No recording." And so that threw me off, because I felt it was important to maintain eye contact and to maintain the threads of our conversation, because he could be elliptical, he could be a little puzzling, a little vague, a little over-poetic, and you got to really pay attention to keep up with him. And so I suddenly had to write everything down onto a notebook instead of relaxing and keeping it more conversational. Now I just scribble after he had said something. So that threw me off. But again, that was not a bad. It didn't work out. I mean, it worked out all right, because we saw each other at a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young concert a few months later, and from the sound of it, he thought it was quite accurate, and to the point where he thought maybe I snuck a tape recorder on and recorded the whole thing. So that was kind of flattering, I suppose. But it worked all right. But he was really paranoid at the time, because people were all bootlegging his stuff, going through his trash cans, and exploiting him top to bottom. And so I kind of understood what he was going through.
Oh, yes, I can only imagine. It's a tough one being at that level.
Yeah.
So an amazing career. You've also done a number of books on music and other subjects. Have you anything? I know you're working on other subjects we'll talk about, but any book projects you're working on?
Oh, there are some There's going to be a reissue of one of my first books, Hickory Wind, The Life and Times of Graham Parsons. A publisher in the UK wants to put it out, so we're allowing that to happen. That'll be coming out within a couple of months, probably. I just signed the contract a few minutes ago, actually, to get back to them. And it'll be only in the UK, this particular edition. Oh. And I did just a little updating at the end of the book so that it wouldn't just stop in 1991 or whatever it was, the last time I went and looked at it and updated it.
Yeah.
And there is, there's interest on the part of others for other book ideas. I'm not really looking for work, so we'll see. Right now, I am... what am I doing? I'm writing a column in the Chronicle here in San Francisco about radio every other Sunday, and I've been doing that for probably 20 years,
right,
and on and off. And then I am actually programming an online station for a jam band called Moon Alice, one word. And so I also DJ for them. I'm on right now, actually, from 9 to noon and 9 to midnight pretty much every day.
Oh, wow.
The rest of the station is pretty much streaming with the other band, with the band members all taking turns saying a few words now and again, whereas I do a more topical show that talks about, like, for example, what's going on here with the festivities around the Summer of Love anniversary, or new releases, or what happened at Monterey this time around. Just kind of whatever is in my head, I can talk about it and put that into the show. So that's two things, and I have a secret project that I can't tell you about, but I'm immersed in that, and that's going to keep me busy for the next 2 or 3 months, and I just can't announce it yet. They don't want the people who hired me don't want it to be announced yet until it's more definitive that this is going to go on. And okay, so when that happens, it'll be fairly surprising news.
Ooh, enigmatic. I like it.
Yeah, right.
Radio, obviously, you do the column. I just want to thank you so much for, you know, keeping the interest in radio alive in the Bay Area and where it's and where the column's syndicated. Obviously, that's why I do radio. I still think it's the best medium there is. What do you see as the future of radio in its form and the forms it's morphing into?
Well, it's changing every day, it seems like, or every couple of months because of technology, bringing forth different platforms for what we know as radio. The communication from a programmer or personality to a larger community, hopefully, of listeners. And now you can still achieve that, but it's less available on commercial terrestrial radio. The corporatization, the formatting, the programming is all in fewer and fewer hands, and that has robbed the medium of a lot of its original appeal of being part of the community, being able to offer live news and information and opinions, and now it's all canned. Not all, of course, but still, by and large, it's very difficult now to find what you could find not too many years ago. But the fact is, you can find it if you go to online, or you go to non-commercial radio, you go to community radio, you go to college radio, you pay some bucks and go on satellite and listen to Sirius XM. I do that and find, I'm sure it's not free form, but when you're creative and imaginative enough, you can create the feel of free form, and I get that from Deep Tracks and The Loft and a couple of other channels there on Sirius XM. But I also can get it online. You can find stations for whatever music you most want to hear. You can now create your own semblance of a radio station through Pandora and Spotify and Amazon. Of course, that's just glorified playlists. But with a Pandora, they'll just take music you like and then surprise you with music that you might like or may not have ever heard of, but that falls within the range of the music you told them you do like the most. And so that's kind of fun to do on your own. But by and large, the world has changed. The methods of delivery of radio communications have changed. But I believe that it will always be with us one way or another, because people still do need to have that connection with that voice in the night or day, and to have live and local information and entertainment. That's still the most popular kind of radio that there is. And so, I think it will be here in one form or another.
Oh, that is great. Talking about music, what type of music are you listening to now?
Well, the same as I always did, which is everything.
Okay.
I would say that I'm not a punk rocker. I'm not a goth metal person. I'm not really into classical music. I'm not into avant-garde jazz. I can't stand smooth jazz. A lot of today's pop music leaves me pretty cold, especially when it is produced with auto-tune. And so, that's a phone call. But anyway, but that leaves a lot of music, and not just oldies and classic rock or whatever. You know, because of my job writing the radio column, I tune into many different formats and will usually sit there for 5-10 minutes to hear the music of today, or just old school music, a little bit of classical. You know, I just want to hear the presentation, hear how the station's doing. So I am exposed to a lot of music, and by and large, I like most of it.
Oh, well, that's pretty good news, I would say, for the future.
Yes.
In terms of radio, obviously, we're with the community radio low power system, which really is the big burgeoning part of the radio sector as we see it. It's spreading across the country and across the world. How do you see that interrelationship, because it's really grassroots community?
Right. Yeah, it's not necessarily for the urban community, the larger cities, because of the disparate community, the people who are seeking music or radio, entertainment, or, of course, local news. But for people in the smaller towns, I think it's vital. I think it's valuable. I think it's that will be hopefully be there for the long run, as long as there are people interested in and passionate about what radio should be about, which is relating to a community of people with like objectives and a need to stay in touch with one another for whatever reason, social or cultural, political, legal, technical, anything. And so I think community radio is going to thrive for many, many years, just as it has been around for at least 40 or 50 years. And so I see nothing but good. I do want to promote community radio more in my column, because obviously I write more about commercial radio than anything else. But I do want to pay attention as much as I can to college radio and community radio.
Yeah,
and public radio.
Yeah, it's amazing how much is happening. It amazes me, the talent that's coming up through it.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Well,
okay, I got to run.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Ben, and good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right. You take care.
And you. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.